From my producer Blake and I at Universe University, we'd like to wish all our listeners a happy Halloween and invite you to join us for today's After Talk, where we welcome back Connor Blunt, the host of The Blunt Report, a podcast about science and expertise with some of the best guests anywhere on the internet.
Well, welcome back to the program. You have the honor of being our first repeat guest.
I do, yeah. That's very nice. I appreciate it.
I thought it would be a fun conversation to have you back on the program for this particular topic, because although I'm sure there are subjects in the arena of science that are probably subjects you're more passionate about or intrigued by than UFOs, which are arguably pseudoscientific, at least in the realm of mainstream academia, but I thought it would make a nice contrast. You're a more scientifically skeptical-minded person, from what I gather, talking about a subject that's a little bit fringe, just in time for Halloween. Is Halloween a big thing in Australia?
In Australia, it's not really. I mean, there's a few sections of Australia that have quite big, I guess, like American populations from, you know, especially the 70s, I guess. A lot of Americans went over for engineering things and building things, I suppose. So there is a few sort of circles of America that you do find, but it's kind of left in the dark. It's more of an adult just drinking thing and no one dresses up. In the UK, it's much, much bigger, which is a shame because I love Halloween, actually.
I've heard that gradually it's kind of seeping into the UK and some parts of Western Europe.
Yeah, well, the UK, it's been big for years, in all honesty. When I was a kid and growing up in the UK, Halloween was a pretty big event. It wouldn't be anything as nearly as big as America, but it's a thing for sure. Because I do believe that Halloween was actually quite a big thing in Ireland once upon a time, and that's sort of closer to its origins, and maybe it just seeped over to the UK from there, and that's why it's probably actually been there a lot longer than the rest of Europe.
Yeah, we could have a long discussion about sort of the Celtic sort of pagan traditions and things like that, and all Hallows Eve in the United States and all that
linked
jazz
in there, right?
Yeah. So I'll extend an invitation to you to kind of share your thoughts. I don't know if you've read much on the subject of UFOs prior to us sending some of our material to you. But, you know, what are your initial impressions, I guess?
Well, actually, I was going to mention before when you said it might not be my hottest topic. I love these kinds of hot topics. I almost love these kinds of topics more than I love harder science topics, because I think it always goes down to the root of sort of what it is to be human. You know, the general person walking down the street doesn't care about quarks and gluons and anything like that, but they certainly care about aliens and Mars and that sort of thing. So I have a huge interest in it, and also the reasons why people believe certain things is a huge reflector of the zeitgeist of people, right? The way people think in society often reflects maybe the pseudoscience they believe or whatever else, because it's usually filling some sort of gap. And the UFO one is a pretty interesting one, because I think it's a discussion of two parts, right? There's one main part, which is the first question, which is, do aliens exist? Right? As simple as that.
Right.
Is there life elsewhere? Yeah, that's one main part of it. And then the second part is, if we say they exist, if they are around, can they actually come and visit us? And they are two pretty, you know, distinct points of conversation. And, you know, the UFO one, particularly in terms of what you'd say conspiracies, I suppose, is one of the ones that is more, I would say, realistic. You know, there's some, starting from the absolute worst, if we think of like telekinesis or being able to bend metal with your mind, you can wash that out pretty much straight away, just saying it doesn't, the laws of physics say it can't happen, right? So that's you can finish that straight away. And then you get to things like flat earth, similar, you can say that the laws of physics, gravity doesn't allow that to happen, right? That's another thing. And then you get maybe to something like chemtrails, which is, you know, can planes fly? Yes. Can they shoot stuff out the back? Yes. Is it possible that a government structure is doing this kind of thing? Starting to get a little bit iffy. Also, another point is it possible to make chemical compounds that really can control a person's mind? Probably not. That one's easy, semi-easily thrown out. The UFO one is a bit weirder because it's like, if aliens do exist, then scientists need to sort of think about the question, are they visiting? Is it realistic that they visit? And, you know, it's a hard one to discuss. I'm not sure where you guys sit on it.
I think the most tantalizing sort of fringe topics out there often contain little kernels of truth. And I guess the premise behind chemtrails is that people's mind, as you said, people's minds are being controlled by the chemtrails. There's a lot of people who believe that the government's sort of manipulating, I shouldn't say a lot of people, that's misleading, but there are people who believe that the government is manipulating the weather and causing hurricanes and typhoons to hit in certain places, causing, you know, maybe Southern California to be warm and sunny all the time, what have you. And that's an interesting one to look into because there was a lot of stuff written, particularly at the dawn of the space age in the 1950s, about, well, could we seed clouds? Could we manipulate the weather? How will being able to observe weather and climate from outer space have an influence on that? And so it's very easy to take those kernels of truth and say, oh, well, here we are so much later. Surely governments have found a way to, you know, control our minds or manipulate the weather. Because it isn't as though the scientists of the world and the governments of the world never had these thoughts occur to them of like, oh,
of course,
wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate the weather? Wouldn't it be great if we can control people's minds?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure Saudi Arabia, like, does use cloud seeding to actually generate rain.
Cloud seeding is real.
Yeah.
And
certain amount of weather alterations are also real, but you can't generate, you know, a typhoon like Japan has just seen or something like that. It's just the amount of energy that is in that, like, it's a human organization cannot, you know, sort of foster that much energy or even understand it enough to do that sort of thing. But yeah, cloud seeding, like you said, is definitely a real thing, right?
We won't bring up how much energy a nuclear weapon inside of a hurricane might actually
it's a drop in the ocean, quite literally.
Yes. Yeah.
But so I would say that UFOs definitely fall into the same category in that there's a kernel of truth, as you know, you were just discussing, that the idea is plausible that extraterrestrials exist, and there's nothing impossible in the notion that they might have visited the Earth now or at some point in the past. But as we talked about in the program, this idea of Sagan's paradox I found very interesting was that if the Earth is just one of many planets that host life, then why would aliens be so interested as to visit Earth, you know, weekly, daily, every single year, you know, with the level of frequency that some of these reports come in. On the other hand, if the Earth is very rare and there are almost no other planets like the Earth, then there wouldn't be a lot of aliens around in the Milky Way galaxy to visit. And the ones that did exist would live probably a long way off in our cosmic neighborhood.
Or I like the other idea of that is that they could be existing on opposing spectrums of where our existence is now.
Interdimensional beings, perhaps?
Well, just that technologically speaking, they're far beyond or far below what we are. And so, so far, and what we look for in active life on other planets is we're looking for some of the biomarkers of lesser life, like bacteria, things like that, that are on other planets. But there aren't. We don't necessarily know what the biomarkers would be for a more advanced civilization than that of ours.
There's that old quotable line from, I don't know if you're a big Star Trek fan, Connor, but
I'm not, but I might have heard it.
The character of Dr. McCoy turns to Captain Jim Kirk and says, "It's life, Jim, but not as we know it."
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's true, right? And one of the difficult things that I think we have when we analyze the sort of UFO thing and the alien thing is it's quite literally impossible to think about these things outside of an anthro point of view, right? Anything that we do, it's impossible to view it outside of an anthro point of view. So even with the Sagan paradox, that's something I think about a lot, but us claiming why would they care about us is kind of an anthro thing. We've analyzed that through our own brain. Maybe they would care about us. If we saw an alien species, we'd certainly care about them. So it's so impossible to actually make a judgment on what they think. And you know, luckily, actually, a couple of episodes ago, I had a guy called Frank Marchese. He is a senior planetary scientist from SETI, right? So I'm off the back of discussing aliens.
That was recently, wasn't it?
Pretty recently now. It was a couple of months ago now, but fairly recently. And it was an awesome episode. I really, really enjoyed it.
It was a great listen, by the way, too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Definitely.
Thank you. And I had a lot of people reach out to me, too, which is cool. A lot of people are interested in aliens, believe it or not. But he dropped a few amazing facts, which sort of really changed me, and one that I'll share with you definitely now, which is something that they've quite recently found out, the planetary scientists there. So it's the fact that when you look up at the night sky and you see all those stars, think of all the stars that you see on, you know, a nice clear night. Every one of those stars has on average two planets orbiting. Mm-hmm. And of those planets, 10 to 30% of them are in the habitable zone, just like Earth. So you put those sheer numbers into perspective, then it also becomes a discussion of, like, not how low the probability of life is, but, you know, where the life is, because there is just so much. It's so hard to picture for us, knowing what we know about biology, to picture a universe with all those sort of habitable planets that doesn't have life. And I think that was a pretty amazing fact.
Yeah, and we would definitely, if you have anything topical to inject based on that discussion, because I think SETI is a very interesting field, because some people have talked about how it's funny that Carl Sagan was very hostile to the idea of UFOs, but very much pro SETI work.
Funny, right?
And you could say that, well, in all this time that so-called ufologists, which, you know, is kind of derided as pseudoscientific, but all this time ufologists haven't managed to really find an alien artifact or an alien spacecraft or any real piece of hard evidence. Mm. So isn't it time to give up this fruitless search? But you could also say, if you wanted to criticize SETI work, you could say, well, in all this time, SETI researchers haven't really managed to find any evidence that alien radio signals are being transmitted out there. So doesn't it seem like a fruitless search? That was certainly the opinion of, I want to say it was Senator William Proxmire, who officially, in the United States, officially shut down the idea that we would give any tax dollars to SETI research, because it was just too fringe, the idea of using American tax dollars to search for extraterrestrial radio signals. So all SETI work in the United States, and I'm pretty sure most around the world, is privately funded, not publicly funded by governments.
It is, yeah, I believe so, yeah. I mean, one of the beautiful things about SETI, though, is, this is sort of slightly off topic, is that a lot of what it finds just helps the greater body of knowledge of astronomy, right? So it's not necessarily like we haven't found aliens, so it's a failure. The amount of stuff they've found in terms of exoplanets, in terms of what is required for life, what the universe itself looks like, is huge. And maybe if it had a different title, it would have got some taxpayers' dollars, because it would have seemed like something that was super successful.
The search for anomalous radio signals.
I think the other thing to take into consideration with that is that Sagan's interests were in things outside of Earth and in things in the stars. And so he could manipulate, I mean, if you wanted to say he was manipulating, whatever, but his interests were in things outside of what was going on Earth. And looking into UFOs and what we on Earth are doing about them was trying to turn the telescope or magnifying glass around to look at what we as human beings are doing about it. And so that was kind of outside of his.
And I wouldn't use the word manipulate necessarily, but I think scientists are always trying to persuade other entities to fund their research. And it's this
job, right?
And this competition, I think it's difficult, because it always has to come at the price of some other project or some other interest that might be equally valid, but you have to, you know, frame it in terms of, well, this is clearly a far better use of taxpayer dollars than this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things as well. Like, there was something else that we discussed on that podcast, which I think is probably a little bit more relevant in terms of the reality of aliens. So a lot of people might think it's fruitless because we found no evidence whatsoever. But one of the things we talked about, which I sort of, you know, I subscribe to a lot now, I think about it quite a bit, is something you mentioned called the Christmas tree theory, which you guys have probably heard of before, which is like the universe is so big, right? Way bigger than we can expect. And the time scales are also so long. And you think about us humans, you know, we've been here for like 250,000 years. And of yeah. that, we've only been technologically advanced for like the last 10 sort of years. And even some of that, you can't even argue is that technologically advanced. What we are now has been, you know, a couple of hundred years since the Industrial Revolution. So one thing that he mentioned is that these intelligent civilizations come up in such a small period of time that it's like a Christmas tree. Like, imagine a huge Christmas tree covered in lights, right? And the lights flash. So one of the lights turns on in the bottom left-hand corner of the Christmas tree, and then another light turns on in the top right-hand corner of the Christmas tree. And they are so far away that they are never going to know of each other's existence. Mm. And then because it's so quick on the long time scale of the universe, those two lights turn out. And then another two turn on that are so far away. And what you need in order for two intelligent civilizations to actually understand of each other's existence is two of the Christmas lights basically blinking up into existence right next to each other. And the probability of that occurring yeah. on such a huge time scale, on such a huge size, is almost impossible. And I think that's a pretty realistic way to look at it.
I had a friend long ago who's an astronomy student. And she had a T-shirt that had, at the bottom of the T-shirt, there was a radio dish. And in the upper right-hand corner on the shoulder of the T-shirt was a star. And the radio dish mm-hmm. has a speech bubble saying, hey. And the star has a speech bubble protruding from it saying, sup.
Yeah, okay.
And the distances for any conversation, let alone any mm-hmm. exchange of messages, are just so staggering. And it's so tragic to think we don't know how quickly technological civilizations might self-destruct. So, you know, knock on wood, each day that we go as a species sort of makes us could make us a little more optimistic, or just that we're a little bit more lucky. We're playing the odds and we're still around.
Definitely. And again, one thing that Frank said, is that maybe in the future, the idea of life is just a completely different idea. And he was discussing the possibility of like us sort of becoming more joined with the machines that we make. And we're looking for these, you know, we're looking on these huge distances across the universe where we need massive signatures for us to be able to even pinpoint anything, right? And he says, right. maybe in the future we just become these tiny 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter cubes of information that just shoot around the universe that have almost no signature whatsoever and would be absolutely impossible for us to find. And that's sort of what, you know, you guys were mentioning before, like we might be looking for these wrong signs of life.
Right. Yeah, so I'll throw out my skepticism on the subject Please. Of extraterrestrials visiting the Earth, because I'm doing that in preparation. I'm buttering you up for me to pivot to the other side, because I do think there are some aspects of the UFO phenomenon that have been unfairly derided as pseudoscientific. I think there is some validity to a lot of the claims that at least that J. Allen Hynek made as an actual astronomer, but to come at it from the skeptical angle, you talked about us sort of anthropomorphizing extraterrestrials in our mind, and they certainly are in popular culture and films. And so one of the skepticism that I would express is that we've already sent robotic explorers to different parts of our solar system, and technically probes like the Voyager spacecraft are now interstellar spacecraft. Mm. So we've already done that, and the first spacecraft of the other star systems are almost certainly going to be robotic probes. And we're already talking about now, you know, Ray Kurzweil writes all about the singularity, about human beings merging with machines and artificial intelligence and using that to augment our evolution. And when we look at some of the things that are on the horizon for our own species, it begins to seem more and more absurd, the idea that, for instance, at Roswell, there was this UFO that crashed, and there were four tiny little extraterrestrial pilots inside this little flying disc, you know, zipping around from star system to star system in their frail little bodies, and they got struck by a bolt of lightning, and their ship promptly, you know, after making a journey from the other side of the Milky Way galaxy, crashed...
Light years away.
Yeah, crashed in the New Mexico desert. And even the idea of flying saucers or UFOs, that it's very much the idea of, oh, well, what would our species look like 100 years from now? Well, at 100 years from now, we might have flying saucers that can travel at 1,000 miles per hour and zip around outer space or the planet Earth. But it would probably be, you know, maybe 100 years from now, maybe 500 years from now. Really, in the grand scheme of things, in the fairly near future, that sort of technology would be within our grasp. It wouldn't surprise me if in 500 years we were visiting the nearest stars, at least with robotic probes. But so the funny thing is, the way I see it, extraterrestrial life, if it exists, and Blake alluded to this a moment ago, if it exists... it's probably much less advanced or much more advanced, because in order for it to be just 100 years ahead or just 100 years behind, we're talking about like abiogenesis or panspermia, some mechanism through which life arose. Life would have to have come about on that planet in some distant star system almost exactly the same moment that it did on the planet Earth. And I think it's much more likely we'll find something that's a billion years less advanced than us, which would be, you know, microbial life or primordial slime, or something a billion years more advanced than us. And a billion years more advanced than us, that's something that's, you know, we're not talking about aircraft that can fly through the air a little bit a little bit more quickly than the average jet fighter. We're talking about something that's incomprehensible. That meeting that would be comparable to an ant meeting a human being. It would just there'd be no way for us to conceptualize it in our minds.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of goes with the Christmas tree theory too, right? It's like these functions of time are so huge that to say that it's, a shift of 100 or 200 years is fractions of fractions of fractions of percentage of time. It's inconceivable. It's unrealistic. So it is, like you said, I think it is shifted one way or the other. And I think that is one of the arguments against UFOs that really sticks out to me is, you know, what you were saying. They're in flying saucers. They're in their little sort of standing on two legs. They look like people. When we think about aliens, we're not thinking about aliens. Secretly, we're thinking about us, right? And we're seeing, you know, another guest that I had, Alan Duffy, he said, when we look at aliens, we're wondering if the evolutionary dice were rolled another way, what kind of would we turn out like? And that's what we're thinking about with aliens. And, you know, isn't it funny that all aliens, well, most aliens, seem to always go to North America? Isn't that strange that they choose that as a destination?
So I was going to ask you about that, actually, because I do think that that's, and maybe this is just my, you know, what is the term? It's like ethnocentrism, where you think that everything comes from wherever you are. But I don't hear a lot about like giant UFO reporting from countries outside the United States.
There are some, but I mean, there's not. I know Russia has a number,
there's a UFO that in 2010 there was a very prominent UFO sighting that caused an airport to close in China, because the UFO was over the airport, and a lot of people saw that. There's some ones we're going to just briefly address in the episode in Papua New Guinea. So you could argue that it takes place all around the world, but the really intense phenomenon in the late 1940s.
I was going to say the majority, right?
Yeah, from the late 1940s through like the 1960s. It was incredibly common to see UFOs in the Cold War era United States. And there were enormous, staggering numbers of UFOs reported in that time period. And in the Soviet Union, an analysis of their press found almost nothing about UFOs. And the one reference that they did find... Yeah, I think the... I want to say that... that the United States Air Force or the CIA looked into it And because they were like, is this happening in the Soviet Union or is it just happening in the United States? Trying to get a barometer for what's going on in the situation. And they found one reference to it in Soviet journalism and press. And it was, apparently there are a lot of UFO sightings in the United States right now. And nobody's sure what to do with that.
That's hilarious.
But
yeah, it just shows.
At the same time, though, my argument, again, shifting back to being more of a UFO advocate, I would say that the Soviet Union did not have the same sort of free press or the same sort of circus that the United States, that American journalism had at the time. So it's highly possible that Stalin and other Soviet leaders were like, there's no reason to panic our population.
Tell the populace.
Yeah, yeah. Because and that was the whole, I think, the whole panicked response of the Air Force and the CIA and some other government entities. It wasn't necessarily that they knew and were 100% certain the United States was being visited by extraterrestrials and they wanted to calm the public, but they knew that something unusual might be going on and that could excite a war-weary American public for a whole host of different reasons. And if I had to guess, this is pure speculation, but if I had to guess, I would say that the Soviet government said, if this is causing quite a stir in the United States, we want to
kill that,
keep a lid on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, I guess to take a moment to put my cards on the table, like I said, I really enjoy these sort of discussions. What bothers me the most about it is sort of both ends of the discussion, right? You get sort of people who just love conspiracies, and it seemingly like anything you could say to them, they would find some way around that fact to then still believe their conspiracy, right? And they are ridiculous humans. They are very hard and difficult to fit into our society, and hard to see any way that that is conducive to a better society, you know, right? Those people who just love a conspiracy and don't really care that much about the facts. But then on the flip side to that, you have the opposite. There's a lot of sort of famous-ish skeptics, I suppose. And quite a few of them I don't like either, because I feel like they are the same but opposite, right? You can almost put any sort of evidence to something that's a little bit unusual in front of their faces, and they don't necessarily even consider it. And that bothers me too. I do like some sort of middle ground where you do actually consider on a serious term, like what you're doing as well, right? Like seeing the good sides of it, the bad sides of it, and certain possibilities. So for me, like, I 100%, I don't even want to say believe, I know for a fact that there is some sort of life out there in the universe. And it might not be intelligent life and little green men, but there's definitely, I think even within our solar system, we're going to find some sort of bacteria under the surface of Mars or in Europa or something like that. I think that's incredibly realistic with what we know about astronomy. From there, I think it's quite easy to extrapolate that there would be intelligent life at some point on the timescale. Where it gets funny for me is, are they really visiting us? I don't think it's necessarily that realistic, but I could easily be sort of swayed with a good enough bit of evidence. And the reason I'm not necessarily swayed at the moment is I just think there's a lot of other explanations that would be more realistic and fit into what we know about the universe. And there's one thing that I did want to sort of mention to you guys, which I'm not sure if you looked up, but I just finished reading a book called Why We Sleep by a guy called Matthew Walker. And it's just, you know that one, right?
We have long discussions about it, actually. About
You read it?
Well,
no, I did not.
We heard an interview with him. And,
right,
and
he was on Joe Rogan and a few other podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed the Joe Rogan bit quite a bit.
Right, yeah. Awesome book. I really, really enjoyed it. And from there, I sort of read actually one other book about sleep and did a bit of other reading. It's a bit of a kind of passion of mine at this moment in time. But he discusses one thing in there that sort of made me go down a rabbit hole, explaining a lot of these sort of paranormal activities or religious sort of interventions and activities as well, which is the phenomenon of like sleep paralysis, right? Mm-hmm. And he thinks that sleep paralysis could be a good explanation for it. And I don't know if you guys have ever experienced it, but I get sleep paralysis with a fair amount of regularity. So I probably get at least one every month, I think. And some of them are quite benign. Some of them are me lying on my side and I'm sort of acknowledging that I'm trying to wake up and can't, and it's not really panic-filled. And some of them are positively confronting and horrible, and I still think about now and I can't get back to sleep. There was one moment that really sticks in my head that happened about a year ago, was when I was lying in bed here in Korea when I just arrived, actually. And I was sort of lying on my side, half on my back. And I remember opening my eyes, and there was someone sitting at the end of my bed, on my legs at the end of my bed. It's not that it felt like there was someone there. They were sitting at the end of, on the end of the bed. I could see them there facing away from me, and they were putting their like their hand on my leg, and I could feel the weight of their hand on my leg. Like, I could feel it so strongly. Huh. When I woke up, I was super shook up by it, and it made me really think sort of the next day, if I was slightly religiously inclined, or if I was slightly inclined to a belief in aliens, just even a tiny bit, that would be it for me. You know what I mean? I would be, yeah. I would extremely automatically think I got visited by an alien or an angel or a demon or something like that. Because I don't think those things necessarily exist, I just took it as what it was, which is sleep paralysis. I don't know if you guys have sort of heard about that or what your thoughts on that, but yeah, I think that could be a big portion of what these people experience.
So in sleep paralysis, you could attest to this. Is it typically that there's some sort of dream state or half asleep state when your body is paralyzed? You're not conscious staring at your ceiling, the ceiling of your bedroom typically, right?
Well, so sleep paralysis, when we have a few different types of sleep, but the two major types of sleep is REM sleep and NREM, right? And REM right. sleep is known as the major dream sleep. We dream in both, but that is the major dream sleep where we have the crazier dreams. Now, our brains paralyze our body during REM sleep. You are completely paralyzed, which sounds right. so sort of scary and weird, but it's true. So basically what happens in this instance is your brain is shifting out of the REM sleep but hasn't yet triggered the thing to stop you being paralyzed yet. So you are literally paralyzed, yet you are in a different state of sleep. So what often happens is you wake up, or you get close to a point of waking up, yet your body still has the sort of compounds going through it to keep you paralyzed. So you are essentially, some people talk about it like they are fully conscious. And for me, it goes back and forth. I'm either sort of semi-conscious to more fully conscious. But yeah, you remember it more than you'd remember a dream, if that makes sense.
So if you had to guess in this circumstance where it felt like a person was in the room sitting on you, it would probably be a mixture of sleep paralysis with some very vivid dream state.
100%. And that's the thing, depending on where it falls on the spectrum, you know, I hear people with sleep paralysis where there's crowds of people in the room, there's things occurring, they are in a different place, they're in a different city, yet they can acknowledge their consciousness, but they're sort of, it's a mixture of their dream and the reality, and that, I guess, that's where it comes from, you know?
Yeah, and so it's an interesting subject, because while it feels like a tangent on the one hand, on the other hand, there's the alien abduction phenomenon, which I didn't want to even touch in this episode, because it's a whole nother bag of worms, yeah, and we're just opening up definitely. Pandora's box. And what I would say is, you know, anybody, it's like your experience with sleep paralysis. Anybody who has a very vivid experience and is sincere about it, I don't think their subjective human experience is something we need to toss out entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's very difficult. And I think it's difficult. The UFO issue is difficult because there are some people with impeccable credentials who claim mm-hmm. to have seen something flying up in the air that they could not explain and are very adamant about that. But how much stock can science really put in people's subjective experiences and how they perceive the world? Now, the UFO thing is interesting because sometimes UFOs are picked up on radar and you have aircraft in the air that are sighting these UFOs and you've got the radar and sometimes there are photographs. So there's a little bit of what could be argued as corroborating evidence, certainly not proof mm-hmm. of anything that we could nail down. But that to me is a little bit more interesting from an intellectual perspective than someone who has nothing but the very bold claim.
I was abducted. Yeah.
That I was kidnapped by aliens. Mm-hmm. It is yep. clearly strains credulity.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely one of the pieces to the puzzles, right? And I think that's why the abduction stories to me just aren't realistic. The things that really messed in my head is, you kind of sort of mentioned it there, is when you get, yeah, like the Air Force and stuff mentioning things that they see, or even, you know, famously at the moment, Bob Lazar and stuff, some of the stories that he's talking about. That's the stuff that really messes with me, because that's getting a little bit closer to reality. And then you've really got to, you've got really got to sort of dig deeper to try and find what else it could be if you were trying to be skeptical. The thing with Bob Lazar, like you hear him speak and he seems quite legitimate, and you must then take a moment to go, okay, well, there's two options here. He's either telling the truth, or he's openly made a story to tell us and he's lying the whole time, or alternatively, he's severely mentally ill and we don't know, and all of this has been a grand delusion. That's a weird one.
It's, you know, he's very arguably persuasive, and I think at the very least you'd have to say Bob Lazar is no dummy. You know, he's a very intelligent person, and that much is clear. But funny enough, in the community of ufologists, a lot of ufologists are bitterly divided. Stanton Friedman, who wrote this book about Roswell, kind of reawakened enthusiasm about the Roswell, New Mexico supposed UFO crash in the 1970s when he wrote this book. Says, oh, Bob Lazar is a fraud. He's a liar.
Wow.
And this is a man who believes that aliens, Stanton Friedman believes aliens did crash in Roswell, New Mexico, and we did recover extraterrestrial bodies, but Bob Lazar is a fraud. And it's very funny to see these little niche groups arguing amongst themselves about who's
infighting.
Who's legitimate, who's illegitimate, who's, you know.
Really. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. It definitely does get weird. Some of the things Bob Lazar says, I'm quite like, not just Bob Lazar, a few others that are sort of in a similar position. I do get, wow, that could be pretty amazing. Then some of it seems scientific and legitimate until you dig a little bit deeper and you're like, maybe not so much. I know the big thing with Bob Lazar is like he anticipated some chemical element or something like that as a fuel source.
Yeah. I forget what it was called, but it's supposedly what powers the like anti-gravity thing.
But for our listeners who may not know, since we don't address it in the episode, Bob Lazar is essentially a man who claimed to have worked at Area 51, claimed to be a graduate of MIT, and claimed to have seen and, I guess, worked on briefly extraterrestrial technology that had been recovered from alien spaceships that have crashed. I just want to, in case anybody's listening and doesn't know who Bob Lazar is.
Good idea. But the chemical element one is like one of the things that really flashes up on my sort of nonsense radar, because anyone with a basic sort of knowledge of chemistry can dictate that technically all elements are possible, right? Technically all elements are possible in the way that you just have to add an extra proton and then you get the next element. He didn't predict anything. He hasn't said, I know that this exists because aliens have told me. No, I can predict that there's going to be element 270 right now, and then maybe in 500 years they're going to have systems in place to be able to make such a large, unstable element. Stuff like that is like, it sounds good to the general public, but anyone with year 12 college sort of level chemistry can say otherwise.
It's strange that not to interrupt you, it's strange that, you know, we could argue everybody has told a lie at some point in their life to keep things on an even keel, but I think there's a whole nother level of deception in, I guess, what I would call bullshit artistry. Where there's a very tiny portion of the population that are very clever, very intelligent, and very creative, who can create this sort of false narrative that is very compelling. I would say Bernie Madoff in the United States was one such guy who managed to convince a lot of perfectly intelligent people, like, oh, this is going to be a great investment. Please take my money. Why didn't I give you my money sooner?
Yeah, that's a big point.
But to me, it's gaslighting on a level that is just staggering to me, and I don't claim to be able to see through it either. But there are definitely people out there that can convince you of some really fantastic things. And it's I haven't read a lot about Nostradamus, for instance, but the prophecies of Nostradamus, or anybody making prophecies or predictions about something that's going to happen in the future, that's very fascinating, because if it's vague enough, then you can always claim to be vindicated at some point in the future. And even, you know, you can you can kind of glean details, you know, mediums and people who claim to be able to speak to people's dead relatives and things like mm-hmm. that can glean certain details from talking to the person and come up with, oh, I'm seeing, you know, a family member that was an alcoholic in at some point in your past. Yes, that's my Uncle Ed. Oh, I know. I knew it was an uncle.
Every family member in, you know, the developed world as an alcoholic, right? An alcoholic right. uncle. That is one thing that I sort of wanted to mention, how you were talking before about the credibility of some of the claims. For me, I don't really care about the person that's bringing the claims. Now, there is one thing that you must say that, like, if it's someone who's very mentally ill or alcoholic or a drug abuser, then the chances of them seeing things actually being mentally ill is high. But I don't buy into this nonsense of, like, just because someone's a doctor or a lawyer, suddenly what they're saying is more legitimate. It doesn't matter who you are, the fallibility of your mind is equal across all planes, basically, right? You still don't have good recollection of memories because you are a human. You still have the possibility of extrapolating in your mind like we have through all of human history, where we see a rock and we think it moved, or we think it has a face of a lion because that's the way the human brains how they work. You still have right. that. You still have all of the media and all of the stories that you grew up listening and reading to and movies that will make you think you have seen little green men. You still have all these things regardless of who you are. So I don't really buy into the sort of more legitimate individual saying it, so it must be true. The ones that are a bit weird for me are the Air Force ones, because that's like an entity that's doing it and not necessarily an individual, and they're the harder ones to explain. But I like you said too, the individual claim stuff to me is not really evidence in any stretch of the imagination. The weirder ones for me are, I guess, the pictures and whatever else.
And I have a hard time with the government conspiracy ones, because I was a part of the military for a little while.
Yeah.
And, like, it seems really inconceivable to me that there could be this grand cabal of something going on, and I could have never accidentally walked into the wrong room at the wrong place and either, like,
heard.
You know, I'd not seen anything, you know? But, I mean, I'm also, like, if I'm being even about my opinion about it, is that, like, you know, all things are containered in a certain way where I never met any Navy SEALs from what I knew during my time, but I could have, you know.
We have actually, Blake and I have stayed up many a late night, you know, having discussions about Bob Lazar and,
yeah.
and wow.
all these sorts of things. And, you know, I never served in the United States military or got a top secret security clearance or anything like that. So it's a completely foreign world to me. But when we did get to talking about it, and one of the interesting examples that I think you brought up, Blake, was the strange-looking stealth helicopters in the Bin Laden raid, where you actually worked on helicopters in the military. And we talked about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you said, oh, well, I had never seen anything like those weird-looking helicopters in the Bin Laden raid. And so it's like those existed as this experimental aircraft, and you never saw it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that makes me believe that, like, I don't know what to believe on one side or the other. I think there was recently another interview on Rogan where he talked to a recently retired commander, Navy commander, that had some actual video footage of these tic-tac-shaped, and they're not calling them UFOs anymore, they're calling them SEA or SEOs, space, something else.
Might have to Google that.
Yeah, there's another title now that they're using for aircraft that are unidentified. But I don't know. And the thing that's really throwing me for a loop, and I'm like, I think last time we talked was about a year or so ago, Connor. And I told you where I was at in my education process of working towards this mechanical engineering degree. And I'm a year further into that, and I'm working into the, like, more advanced physics and stuff like that. And the stuff that I keep questioning myself is just trying to understand energy and energy conservation and how all of this is supposed to work with this technology where supposedly these giant spacecrafts that should weigh thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds are being able to do things that have no mass. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I said at the start of the episode. Like, there's two considerations when you talk about this. It's like, on the one, do aliens exist full stop? And also, is it possible for them to visit us? And one of the other things that always gets to me that I think people forget is, like, the distance of the universe. Our closest star is 4 light years away, right? So considering the fact that, let's say, best case scenario, they can build a ship that travels at the speed of light, it still takes them 4 years to get here, all right? That's our closest star. So any sort of organic being, you know, it's not viable to do that. And then people discuss things like, oh, well, maybe they have different technology and they can do this, blah, blah, blah. Then you're getting into the realm of physics that might not even really exist. There's physicists out there that, you know, that is the universal speed limit is the speed of light, discussing things like, well, maybe we can rip a hole in the universe and pop out the other end. I mean, this is all stuff that might not even really exist. So to me, it's like you've got to just think about the sheer travel time. Like, we want to go to Mars, and to get to Mars, it takes about 160 days to get there on, you know, choosing the right time to depart. If we go at the wrong time, it can take more than a year. So the realism of the situation, on an engineering standpoint, is just really difficult to conceive for me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to talk about other equally plausible or more plausible explanations for UFOs, and that is this notion that maybe the United States military presently has something that resembles a flying saucer. Some people have suggested that stealth bombers could have been responsible for some UFO sightings before they were officially acknowledged. I want to say that the aircraft is, I don't know if you've read a lot of Cold War history, Blake, but was it the U-2 aircraft was one that flew at high altitudes, like something like 70,000 feet or 60,000 feet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the weird, how would you, like, it's boomerang shaped.
You're correct.
Yeah.
So the UFO, so Blake and I have both read through this book, Area 51, by author. Do you remember the author's name?
I don't at the moment.
Mary.
Jacobson?
Annie Jacobson?
Annie Jacobson.
Annie Jacobson wrote this book, Area 51, where she talked about the notion that a lot of UFO sightings in the 1950s were U-2 sightings, and that seeing this aircraft, this big silvery looking boomerang shape, flying at very high altitudes, it would have looked like a UFO. Definitely. Certainly. And the United States government couldn't exactly come out at a press conference with an Air Force general and say, yeah, we have this high altitude plane, we're spying on Russia and we're flying over Cuba and all these other things. That's a plausible explanation as well.
I think that's a big thing. You know, when we talk about, like, what the governments are hiding from us and stuff, I mean, the governments definitely do hide things. It's in the national interest to hide things occasionally. And things like this, like what you were mentioning before, Blake, about those helicopters.
Yeah.
Things like that are necessary sometimes, right? And, you know, I think it's quite easily plausible to have a piece of technology that we have no clue about for obvious reasons that governments are using, especially big powers like, you know, France or Russia or the US. I think it's definitely possible. And, you know, you think about SpaceX's, what is it, Starhopper, the one that they want to fly to Mars with. Man, if I didn't know anything about that and I saw that flying in the sky, I would definitely think that was aliens coming. It doesn't look like sort of a terrestrial ship. And I think that's, I think something like that is a realistic idea. One thing I did want to ask, I guess, just for my own benefit, is there any bits of evidence that you found while doing this episode that really has you stumped or really is the best evidence for UFOs, so I have it in my sort of memory bank for the future?
Well, it's just kind of staggering that there are so many cases, even if you're just skimming the top of the cases that, I'll just say, the cases that the United States Air Force considered credible enough to do additional investigation. One of the things I just wanted to address that you mentioned previously about not really being swayed by eyewitness testimony, no matter the credibility of the individual, that's a difficult one in many respects. And I would say that I was fascinated to see an interview with the late Robert Rhines, who I don't know if you're familiar, devoted, no. was an engineer, a lawyer, founded his own law school, and devoted a significant amount of his time to searching for the Loch Ness Monster
in
Scotland. Not a dummy by any stretch, and he gave this very serious interview where he said, he says, I'm a lawyer, and I've spent a lot of time in courtrooms, and I've traveled around Scotland and talked to people who claim to have seen the Loch Ness Monster, and he says, I'm familiar with how to cross-examine people, and when people are lying to me or when people are trying to weasel their way out of a question, he says, and I'm very convinced by a lot of the eyewitness testimony of individuals. And I thought that was interesting from the standpoint of someone who was a lawyer, but of course it's subjective, and of course you can't really call eyewitness testimony scientific by any stretch, because...
Well, they probably believe that they did see the Loch Ness Monster, and that's why there's no lying when they talk, right?
Right. So that, and yeah, and that's equally plausible. So, but I do think, so there were UFOs sighted over Washington, D.C. in the early 1950s. And that was something that happened in rapid succession over a couple of nights. And clearly there were contacts on radar, there were jets scrambled to kind of intercept them. So there's visual contact, there's radar contact. And you think Washington, D.C., particularly during the Cold War, would be fairly well guarded, that would be something that would be alarming to the Air Force. So those are sightings that I find interesting. I think anytime you catch something on radar, it's
physical.
Yeah, well, it adds to, again, I think it might strain my credibility a little bit to use the word evidence, because I think a lot of people would challenge me on that, because radar is not always infallible. That's something we talk about in the episode, is that just because you saw something on radar does not mean that there was a physical object there, and it doesn't mean that physical object was a metal craft or a flock of birds. When you talk to people about the Loch Ness Monster, a lot of believers bring up sonar, and sonar is another instrument where it's like, that's not always infallible, but it's more credible than a human being.
Definitely.
I know some of the notes that I sent to you mentioned this incident with two commercial airline pilots in, I want to say, the 1940s, who claimed to have sighted this enormous cigar-shaped craft with windows on the fuselage rocketing up into the cloud bank. So you've got a passenger on the aircraft who described something similar. You've got these two fairly well-trained pilots who described it, but alas, you don't have a lot of other corroborating evidence. But that's still, I think it UFO sightings get stranger when you have two or three people or more who are all describing pretty much the same thing.
Same thing.
And I don't know, though, that there's one that would be sort of considered the holy grail of all UFO sightings. And at the end of the day, what you would really want is alien artifacts of some kind, which, of course, that's a fundamental part of the Roswell story. Mm-hmm. But Carl Sagan mentions it in the episode of his program Cosmos, Encyclopedia Galactica, where he says there's always reports of things like crashed flying saucers or alien artifacts. We always have reports of those things and stories about those things, but never the things themselves. There's never been an opportunity for at least mainstream scientists outside of the United States government, if we're, you know, going with the narrative that there's some elaborate cover-up of extraterrestrials, there's never been an opportunity for people to really scrutinize and study that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I did also want to mention is for anyone listening that is sort of interested in any ideas of conspiracies or why this occurs in society or why humans do it, Carl Sagan was the man with this, right? His book, A Demon-Haunted World, is maybe one of the best science books ever written. It's one of my favorite books ever. I've read it a couple of times, and he does such a good job of laying down the realities of these things and the things that aren't real and why they're probably not real, right? And Carl Sagan, like you mentioned before, again, was great in the way that he was a true scientist, in the way that he wanted things to be real, right? He wanted the most outrageous things to be real. He genuinely believed that humans would be going to the stars. He genuinely believed in aliens and lots of other sort of things that I think a lot of scientists would consider a bit on the pseudoscientific side. And he was very open to it. And which is a great thing, which is why I think he's one of the best ever. And yeah, that book, A Demon-Haunted World, he does a great job of talking about these ideas of why these things occur, why humans do these things. And this book was written in what, like, would have been the 70s or something? And it's still so, so relevant now with all the conspiracies that we constantly see cooking around nowadays, you know?
One of the things I've found as a sort of amateur historian is how difficult it can be to get a sense of who a person really is and what their attitudes and feelings really are, no matter, you know, how much of their writing that you read, no matter how many interviews you watch. At the end of the day, you didn't know that person. You didn't have an interpersonal relationship with them. And you don't know really what they were like behind closed doors. There have been some rumors that Carl Sagan, behind closed doors, confided in some of his peers or confided in someone that, yeah, there's a lot to this UFO business that's very intriguing and might merit further study, but you risk so much as a scientist by throwing your weight behind that it's just not possible for someone to retain their career and their intellectual credibility if by even entertaining that, by leaving the door open 1 inch. And that, to me, of course, it's just rumors. Of course, this is pure speculation and it's unsubstantiated. But that, to me, I think is very interesting. And if I were to extrapolate from those rumors, I would say, are you aware that Carl Sagan actually has a paper that he published under a pseudonym? I believe it was Mr. X, about smoking marijuana.
Yeah, I know about it vaguely. You should fill me in.
So it's a very interesting read if you want to see the sort of the private confines of Carl Sagan's mind and his imagination. And he actually reported not feeling any effects of marijuana the first time he smoked marijuana, and said that he then concluded that marijuana must be a placebo effect and that people just believed they were getting high. And I think it says something about the subjective nature of reality that someone as brilliant as Carl Sagan could be sitting there thinking, well, maybe everyone just thinks that they're high and they thinks that they're enjoying smoking marijuana. And then he talks about this very, yeah, and there's this very vivid experience he describes the second time he smoked marijuana that's, it makes it sound like he had a psychedelic experience or something, because it's very, I'm sure, very outlandish. Like, and knowing Carl Sagan, you know, maybe his mind reacted to it a bit differently. But that shows to me that Carl Sagan was very much concerned with the notion that if it ever got out that he enjoyed smoking marijuana in the 1970s or 80s, that would damage his credibility as a intellectual as well. But that he still, in his private life, had his private thoughts, opinions, and curiosities about those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. It's something that we all contend with, and I do sort of feel for scientists that, like, you know, this is a bigger conversation about the problem with academia and where the money comes from and things like that. But I do feel for scientists that do have to do research on things that will get them funding and not necessarily things they care about. And also then they need to watch what they say and watch what they do. And especially it gets even more complex nowadays when you've got scientists who have to be careful about the research they do because they don't want to sort of upset any race or gender or anything like that, you know? There's these societal things that they now need to take into account in a different way that they never had to in the past. And it sort of is tarnishing science a little bit. I think it should just be as free as possible. If you want to do the research for something crazy, you should sort of be able to do it, so long as you can get the funding for it, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's funny with the Carl Sagan thing you mentioned too, because historically, other scientists have done notoriously crazy things. Like Isaac Newton, famously, he had... was so young, he invented calculus, he understood gravity, and then he started the latter years of his life trying to, you know, make different metals into gold and stepped into alchemy. I think that's hilarious. It's great.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I think, why whether we're talking about Carl Sagan or Sir Isaac Newton or J. Allen Hynek, it's very difficult to get a clear picture of who they were. And like looking at any human being, who you are at 25 years old is not who you're going to be at 55 years old. That people's attitudes change and grow and evolve. And my sense of Carl Sagan sometimes is that he was exactly as you described him, that he had an active imagination, he believed in these big ideas, and he wanted to believe in some of these ideas like alien visitation that are even bigger in scope, but he couldn't bring himself to do it as a brilliant scientist because the evidence, you know, the compelling evidence wasn't there. And as he once said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I don't know that any of the evidence for the UFO phenomenon is what I would consider extraordinary. I wouldn't say there's nothing that constitutes evidence, but I wouldn't say that any of it's extraordinary enough to conclude that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. But what I was going to say about Sagan is there are other times when I felt that he might have been unnecessarily hostile to the idea of UFOs and alien visitation. And he frequently brought up the Benny and Barney Hill case. In my opinion, him bringing it up, it was almost a sort of straw man argument that he used to dismantle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for instance, two professional airline pilots seeing some sort of flying craft that they believe had extraordinary capabilities, that has some plausibility to me. Whereas the Betty and Barney Hill case were just two people who later under hypnosis believed that they had been kidnapped by aliens and taken aboard a flying saucer. So to me, it's like, if that's what you're always bringing up, and he brings it up in Cosmos and talks about something called the star map argument, where they were trying to use, you know, different...
In a demon-haunted world as well.
Oh, yeah, in a demon-haunted world as well. I haven't read the book, but I'm familiar that that's in there. So to me, I thought that that's kind of a straw man, where you're kind of taking one of the outrageous cases and saying, all right, this is outrageous on the face of it, and let me dissect it and explain to you why it's even less credible than it seems on the surface. But again, it's trying to understand the attitudes of someone who you didn't really know in a private life. And it's hard to say that about Sagan. And what's fascinating to me about this episode we did, it's harder to say it about J. Allen Hynek as well, is the narrative that ufologists spin is that J. Allen Hynek was an astronomer who was deeply skeptical about UFOs and very gradually became more and more open to the idea that something extraordinary and strange and bizarre was going on in the skies of the United States, and that there were aerial vehicles that were incredibly advanced, perhaps. I don't know that J. Allen Hynek was very careful about saying, he never really came out and said that there were extraterrestrials visiting the Earth, but he just said that the subject of UFOs has merit and is worthy of scientific study. And it took him a long time to come to that conclusion. There are, however, there are skeptics who say that J. Allen Hynek was always a little bit pseudoscientific, and he always had an overactive imagination, and he always wanted to believe in something that was a little bit more outlandish and grandiose and pseudoscientific. So there are two different narratives even about J. Allen Hynek that are kind of difficult to tease apart. Was he this deeply skeptical guy? I think he had a very impressive career, you know, helping to invent the proximity fuse. He became a central part of the Sputnik narrative, and I think found himself on the cover of, I want to say it was Life magazine, because he had a global satellite tracking system that he was working to set up in preparation for America launching their first satellite, and then Sputnik went up, and this mass panic ensued, and he was sort of tasked with finding Sputnik. So, but it's hard to say that was he this guy who always kind of wanted to believe in something outrageous like UFOs, or was converted over a long period of time looking rigorously and skeptically at the evidence. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's one of those things that, again, I mentioned at the start. It's like this spectrum of skepticism. You know, you get people who love conspiracy theories so much that they'll find almost anything to sort of prove it. And then you get the opposite end of the spectrum where, you know, a person would almost never believe anything that's slightly out of the realm of possibility, which isn't correct either. And, you know, I'm of the opinion that all scientists should be just a touch pseudoscientific, just a tiny, tiny bit pseudoscientific, because I want them to be pushing the boundaries into things that don't seem realistic, because some of them will be realistic. And the thing is, you know, what you mentioned, the Carl Sagan quote, you know, we require extraordinary evidence for things. There are things that we know about now that would be pseudoscience if we didn't have the evidence to back them up, right? And even just the fact that I mentioned before, the one that Frank told me about, every star you see has two planets orbiting it, and 30% of them might have habitable planets. If we knew nothing outside of our own solar system and someone told you that, you'd be like, what are you talking about? You have no, that is just a ridiculous, ridiculous idea that that is the truth. And that was the thing with gravitational waves when we found about that as well. Imagine if someone, you could almost picture it like someone who's super woo saying to you, like, yeah, every movement, you know, creates waves through the universe, like that kind of thing. It sounds so woo, but it is actually realistic now. Gravity does make waves through the universe. Things like this that, you know, we do have extraordinary evidence for, and things that seem like they wouldn't be real actually can be. The fact of the matter is the UFO stuff, although it may seem like it could be real, doesn't really have what you mentioned, the extraordinary evidence that we do require.
Yeah, we did an episode on Albert Einstein and black holes that you might appreciate. And what I gathered in sort of doing my research on how the theory of general relativity was received at the time is largely that people really didn't know what to do with it. And that when Einstein did win the Nobel Prize, it was for his work on the photoelectric effect.
Photoelectric effect,
yeah. It was not for general relativity, which in retrospect seems very short-sighted. But general relativity was such a bizarre idea that it wasn't necessarily the scientific community, that physicists and astronomers came out and said, no, that's hokum, no, that's bogus, that's, you know, pseudoscience. But it also wasn't that they all collectively came out and said, this is obviously the way the universe works. Let's give you the Nobel Prize.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like that, right? I think even historically, when with the advent of quantum mechanics was viewed as almost pointless. Yet now, it's essentially how we operate all of our machines on a day-to-day basis. It's such an important part of technology is quantum mechanics. And I think that's always a thing with scientific endeavor. And that's why I say I think all scientists should be just a touch pseudoscientific.
Yeah.
Because I think that we will, you know, we need to discover things that don't seem realistic. And then in 100 years' time, then they'll be important.
Yeah, it's such a difficult question, because if you open your mind a little bit to stuff that is pseudoscientific or larger than life or that strains credibility, that's positive in many ways. But then do you wake up one day as J. Allen Hynek writing books about the UFO you know, phenomenon? I'm coming up with Close Encounters of the First Kind, Second Kind, and Third Kind to classify UFO sightings to study them scientifically. On the other hand, I'm sure there are scientists out there who would argue that a rigorous skepticism and even some amount of hostility to new ideas is the reason that good science turns out the way it does at the end of the day, because it has to be subjected to an enormous amount of scrutiny in order for it to really be accepted into what you would call the established canon of our scientific knowledge. There's a place for that too, for those rigorous skeptics who want to just tear apart the idea. And the conclusions, the scientific findings have merit, then they will survive long past their moment of inception.
It's all required. It is all required, I suppose.
Well,
I guess my closing thoughts on the UFO thing, and the enduring mystery for me is, at least from the late 1940s into the mid-1960s, it seems like the United States Air Force was very convinced that something strange was going on in the skies of the United States. And I don't think that means that they knew for sure what was going on, but I think that they were alarmed by it and they wanted to get a handle on it. I think some of that is probably a product of Cold War era paranoia.
Definitely.
But I think some of it is also a product of the fact that there were a fair number of cases, I would say, that I guess seemed legitimate, or at least had eyewitness accounts and corroborating radar evidence that lent a lot of credibility to those sightings. I've tried to be careful through this whole conversation, not saying like, this is just obvious that aliens were visiting us the whole time.
Yeah. It's a weird one because, I mean, that I guess that is the total closing thought, which I don't think we're the first ones in history to have this very underwhelming conclusion, which is, you know, you've got to be realistic with these things. The fact is, it doesn't really look like they are that realistic, but it doesn't look like nothing. It definitely doesn't look like nothing, and it is something that we should think about. And, you know, you said before about some people don't even think it's deserving of scientific scrutiny. I hate that. I hate those opinions. Everything, in my opinion, is suitable for scientific scrutiny. And even the things that are most ridiculous, maybe the scientific scrutiny will be a lot quicker, like the flat Earth. That's not how planets work. But some of it might take a bit longer, like the UFO stuff. You know, it deserves analysis. It really does.
In the final thought that I would give is just that I think I'm agnostic on the idea of whether extraterrestrials are visiting the Earth now or whether perhaps they have in the past. And I think based on some of the things that I've read and the research that I've done for this episode, I think agnosticism is a defensible point of view, somewhere between taking it all hysterically as fact that extraterrestrials are visiting us and ruling it out entirely.
Yep, it's about right. I agree with you there. I think that's a good approach.
I think it's healthy for us to think about it after everything that we've talked about in human psyche and needing that ability to imagine something that isn't tangible right now to allow you to create the tangible thing in the future. I think that where we are with people thinking that there is a possibility of there being UFOs, and now that we're hearing more quote-unquote scientists or people that are without the quotation scientists coming out and talking about either research that they purport to have been doing with these things or whatever. I'm again trying to be careful. Bob Lazar and some of the other people that are coming out of this whole new tunnel of research into UFOs and aircraft and that such. Even if they are coming up with scientific justifications for what they saw while they were doing research there, I think if it reaches the ears of more brilliant people than them or us or people in our generation or next generation or whatever, it'll be like Star Trek, where you heard about the transporter or the little communicator or whatever, where that was something that was science fictional at the time, but we have little communication devices that we can look at each other on the phone and walk around and there are no wires. That's insane. That's crazy.
Yep.
So I don't know. I think that there's so much. It's really hard to wrap your mind around whether or not it is possible or not.
I think if we regard it dispassionately as a possibility,
yeah,
then sometimes it can provide fuel to young imaginations to dream big and to get into science and engineering and all and physics and all these other fields and pursue what might one day turn out to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Good summary.
Well, if you don't have a lot to add.
Sounds good to me. I'm pretty happy with the input. There's not a whole lot more to say on a topic like this, I suppose. It's a hard one.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you bringing your intellect to bear on it.
Thank you.
We hope you'll join us this November for our next episode in After Talk. We'll be welcoming NASA historian Professor Alex Rowland to discuss the United States Space Shuttle program and to determine whether the Endeavour was a triumph of ingenuity or the tale of a modern-day Icarus.